Welcome to Next on the Tee with Chris Mascaro, where tour players, legends, and the top instructors in the game share their stories, insights, and playing lessons. Join Chris every week as he talks with the greats of the game.
You are the smartest guy I've spoken to on radio or television in my career.
And Chris, again, you're knocking out of the park. You're like 8 under par in this interview.
By having any research, I'm hiring your tail to be the research man. You're the best.
You're a fantastic host and tremendously respected in the golf community.
Yeah, Chris, you do an amazing job, and your listeners are super lucky to have you, and it's always my pleasure.
Chris Mascaro is the king of the golf podcast. Don't miss him on Tuesdays.
Now, here's your host, Chris Mascaro.
Good evening, folks, and thank you for coming back and pressing the play button on this week's edition of Next on the Tee. I appreciate that you continue to make this show a part of your weekly golf content. I'm your host, Chris Mascaro, and I've been looking forward to this week's show for a long time because I have four great friends who also happen to be fantastic guests that I'm going to get to share with you tonight. First up is going to be John Cook. Cookie is one of the great guys in our game. He had a tremendous amount of success as an amateur. He won the 1978 U.S. Amateur Championship. A year later, he helped Ohio State win the national championship. In all, he won 21 times between the PGA Tour and the Champions Tour. We're going to talk about some of those wins, plus the course design work that he's done, particularly at North Star Golf Club outside of Columbus, Ohio. I also want to get his thoughts on the Ryder Cup, the upcoming World Champions Cup on the Champions Tour. So a whole lot to get into with John. Can't wait to have him as part of the show. He's going to join me in just a few minutes. Following him, I'm going to get a return visit from 1978 PGA champion John Mahaffey. And John is a fantastic guest and become a wonderful friend of this show over the last few years. I love it when I get to have him as part of Next on the Tee. We're going to go back to that 78 PGA championship. It was played at Oakmont. We'll hear how he navigated those greens and brought home the trophy despite being down 7 strokes with 14 holes to play. I also want to get his memories of Andy Bean, plus what it was like being a part of that victorious 1979 Ryder Cup team that he was a part of along with Andy Bean. A lot to get into with John as well. Looking forward to having him here tonight. He'll join me about 25 minutes from now. Following him, one of my all-time favorites, Bob Friend Jr., is going to be here. He and I are going to go deep into Western Pennsylvania golf. He played in and won so many tournaments in the Western Pennsylvania area. We're going to talk about those, plus some of his favorite events and favorite courses around the area. He'll join me later on in the hour. And then we're going to round things out with a return visit from top 100 instructor Eric Johnson. He is fantastic. Always makes this segment so much fun to be a part of. Both he and Bob have been great contributors to this show going all the way back to season one. Eric was the director of instruction at Oakmont for almost 20 years. He now spends his summers teaching at Yellowstone Club in Big Sky, Montana. We'll hear what this year was like for him out there. He's back in Pittsburgh now. I'm going to get his thoughts on some of the great courses in and around the Pittsburgh metro area. Plus, he recently took a trip out west to play Pebble Beach, Cypress Point, and Monterey Peninsula Country Club. He doubled down on that by going out and playing Pine Valley after that. You want to talk about a great series of golf courses. It doesn't get much better than those. I can't wait to hear those stories. He is going to join me about an hour from now. So, folks, it's going to be a fun and informative lineup tonight on this week's edition of Next on the Tee. As always, thank you all so much for tuning in and taking the journey with me tonight. Our resident director of instruction, Tom Patry, and I have been working with a company called Kickpoint, and they have done some magical things with our logos and created some polo shirts with some wonderful designs where they take our logos and turn them into designs on a polo shirt. They're absolutely outstanding. Kickpoint Golf is a private label custom golf apparel company making bespoke polo shirts, quarter zips, and hoodies for those selected clubs looking to take their branded game to a whole new level. If you want to check out their apparel, and again, it's going to knock your socks off, send an email to info@kickpointgolf.com. They'll get right back to you. There's no middleman. They're going to go right to the guys that do this work. You're going to check it out, and you are really going to love what they do. I'm going to start showing the polo shirts that they designed for me on my Instagram, @CTMascaro. Check them out there so you can get a sample of what they look like. These guys know where it's at. Now let's talk about golf getaways and buddy's trip locations. When you're thinking about that, think about our friends over at the Macklemore, which is a wonderful resort located just south of Chattanooga, Tennessee, high atop Lookout Mountain. It is a casual two-hour drive from Atlanta, Nashville, and Birmingham. The existing Highlands course is now ranked in the top 100 courses you can play in the U.S. by Golf Digest. The 18th hole is ranked in the top 10 finishing holes in the world. A second course, The Keep, is under construction and will open summer of 2024. The Keep is a Bill Bergen Reese Jones design and features a mile and a half of dramatic cliff edge, with every inch of that edge filled up with a golf hole. A world-class hotel, Cloudland Lookout Mountain Curio Collection by Hilton, will open spring of 2024. Both have incredible views into historic Macklemore Cove, 1,200 feet below. You got to see it to believe it, folks. Stay, dine, and play golf above the clouds at Macklemore. Go online to macklemore.com to book your stay and play package. Now let's talk grips. I want to tell you about Lambkin grips. Every shot, as you know, has its own unique feel. The trick? Feel comfortable with each one. And comfort is built into the very DNA of Sonar Plus Black Grips. Composed of their Genesis material that provides supreme comfort and durability, with their fingerprint technology, creates a strong connection and unforgettable touch. The game changes from shot to shot. The feel on your hand shouldn't. Lambkin. Feel is everything. I also want to remind you about the all-new Stealth 2 driver from TaylorMade. If there's one thing we know golfers want from a driver, it's distance. But there's actually two things we all want. Distance, and let's not forget, forgiveness. That's why TaylorMade designed the Stealth 2 driver with even more carbon for even more forgiveness. To learn more about the new Stealth 2 driver from TaylorMade, visit them online at TaylorMadeGolf.com. Now back with me is 21-time winner between the PGA Tour and Champions Tour, John Cook. John is from Toledo, Ohio, but grew up in Southern California. He went back and played his college golf at Ohio State, where he was a three-time All-American. He helped them win three consecutive Big Ten titles from 1977 to 1979 and the 1979 National Championship. John won six individual titles while he was there at Ohio State. He also won the Les Bostead Award for the lowest stroke average in the conference each year from 1977 to 1979, and he was inducted into the Ohio State Hall of Fame in 1986. John won the U.S. Amateur Championship in 1978 and finished second to Marco Mira in 79. He won several amateur championships, including the California State Am in 1975 and the Ohio Amateur in 1978 and 79. He would later turn pro in 79. He won his first PGA Tour event in 1981 at the Bing Crosby National Pro-Am. He won again in 1983 at the Canadian Open, beating Johnny Miller in a playoff. John has seven top 10 finishes in majors. He was named the 1992 PGA Tour Comeback Player of the Year. In 2013, he was inducted into the Southern California Golf Association's Hall of Fame, and I couldn't be more excited that I get to have him back with me tonight here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Cookie, thanks for coming back on the show.
You know, I love it, Chris, listening to you talk about a resume and what I've done. I've forgotten a lot of that, but you know what sticks out to me? That Les Bostead Award, 3 years in a row. I had forgotten that, honestly, in the Big Ten. So, and, you know, Big Ten's strong in golf, and they have been, and it's great fun. Anytime you want me to come on, I am willing and able. I love talking to you. You're the best. Honestly, you're the best.
Well, I appreciate that very much, John. So let's stay right there in the Big Ten. Before we get into the golf stuff, your Ohio State Buckeyes are sitting number one in the college football playoff pool. Georgia right behind them at number two. Your boys came close last year to beating them in the playoffs. Is this the year they get over the hump?
Well, they were a timeout away from beating that team. I promise you that. That was a very well-timed timeout that they took. But yeah, they were close last year. You know, they had some flaws last year. This year, I'm a little bit surprised, honestly, at the one. Until you beat the guy, I could certainly see where Georgia should be ranked number one. I'm fine with that. It's still, from here on out, Chris, it is win and survive. That's all you do. You cannot lose a game from here on out. You can't do it. I don't care who you are or who you lose to. You cannot lose a game. So You know, those top four teams, that they know that those teams that they're playing, they're getting ready for the best team that they're ever going to play. And Ohio State is no different. Michigan is no different. Georgia is no different. Florida State is no different. Those teams have to win out. One loss will eliminate them. I feel pretty good. I love our defense. I love our will to win. I love our adjustments being made throughout the game, not just the start, but you have to get it to the finish line. Ohio State's been able to do that against a couple of very, very good teams and away on away from the shoe. A pretty good win at Wisconsin. I'll say a pretty good win at Notre Dame. Notre Dame has an incredibly difficult schedule, so they're not going to be at their best every single week. I get that. Penn State at home, that's a nice win. We're going to see where Michigan is as they go to Happy Valley this weekend. We'll see where Michigan is because they have not been tested at all yet. But we'll wait and see. We'll wait and see. I'm pretty good with where we're at. I'd like to see our offense be a little more consistent, a little more healthy as we go along. They have not been healthy this year. But I think the Kyle McCord, with all the haters that are out there, he's 9-0, by the way. He's 9-0. He won a game last year. He's also 8-0 this year. Kyle McCord's got the reins. He's got the steering wheel. He's got a lot of weapons around him. All he has to do is not hit the curb. Just keep it in the lane and throw to your guys. Let your guys get involved. I think Kyle McCord is just fine.
Well, there you go. I tell you, I'm down here in Atlanta. I'm down here in Atlanta. A lot of UGA, obviously. So, you know.
I was there last week, Chris. I was doing the East Lake Cup. I was there last week doing the East Lake Cup. And, I heard a lot of that. And I promise you, if Georgia was one and we were two, I would be fine with that as well. Georgia, until you beat the guy,
you got
to beat the guy.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's where I get kind of sideways in the polls, you know?
Yes,
yeah,
for sure.
Georgia's the guy. They've been
Georgia
in a row.
Is the guy.
How in the world do you leapfrog the guy that's won it 2 years in a row? That's a head scratcher.
25 in a row. How do you leave that guy out? I don't get
right.
I don't get it, honestly.
All right, let's talk a little golf, Cookie. I want to go back to your win at the 1983 Canadian Open. You win that event in a playoff over Johnny Miller. And Johnny was arguably the best player on tour from 73 to 83. You guys went 6 playoff holes, and then you were able to close him out. And Johnny, after the event, I read, talked about and remarked about how calm and cool you were able to stay throughout the stretch run and in the playoff. What do you remember about coming down that stretch, and how were you able to keep your cool?
You know, that's great that Johnny would say that. I've always been a huge fan of Johnny Miller's. He's been nothing but complimentary to me. And, you know, for that to be my second win at the Canadian Open at the time at the, you know, Great Glen Abbey, it was so interesting because playing in that last group, I had a chance at 18. It was the best, to this day, the best golf shot I've ever hit in my life on the 72nd hole. Nicklaus was in the clubhouse, one behind. Johnny was, I knew what score he was on. I needed to make a birdie to tie Johnny Miller. And I drove it in the fairway. And I remember this distinctly. I had 218 yards of the flag, back right hole location. Tiger Woods, about 20 years later, 30 years later, hit 6-iron from the bunker from the same number. I had a 1-iron in my bag and I got called off by my caddy, Dennis Turning. I thought that I could lay the ball up and still make a 4, you know, 8 or 9 times out of 10. I was so confident in my wedge game. Dennis called me off. I got to give him 100% credit. He said, "Cookie, you're swinging good. This is a perfect number for you. I know how you can hit this 1-iron straight up in the air. Just trust it and make a swing." And I did that. And the ball took off just left of the flag, landed just over the water hazard at the time. You know, just trickled over the back of the green and in that back bunker with an easy up and down. I almost made it, honestly. So I have to give Dennis a lot of credit for that. And that calmed me down, Chris, going into that playoff knowing, hey, I just hit one of the best shots I've ever hit in my life under the greatest pressure I'll probably feel for a long, long time. And I pulled it off and I hit nothing but BBs in that playoff. And unfortunately, I couldn't get the golf ball in the hole. I had four chances in a row to end it. And then all of a sudden, Johnny Miller became Johnny Miller. And now he had a 12-footer to end it on the fifth playoff hole, which is the 17th hole at Glen Abbey. And he missed it. And that gave me life. And then I wasn't gonna miss the next one. So for him to say that is really nice. It's very, very cool. But that win to me, coming off, you know, a little bit of an injury, I had missed a little bit of time, and to win there at Glen Abbey, you know, being at that time, it was the fifth major. It got you in the World Series of Golf if someone had won, you know, two majors. So it was a big deal. It's a proud moment of my life to win that one, to win your second. A lot of great players win one. It starts to whittle down, and that table becomes a little bit smaller when you start winning two and you start winning multiples. And that one, that was a very, very special one, Chris.
And John, it's interesting that you mentioned that the Canadian Open was sort of like the fifth major. I think we all look at the fifth Beatle being the Players Championship. But to your point, that was a big deal back in the 70s and 80s to win that Canadian Open. At what point do you think that, why did the Players pass it up? To me, it's such a huge event.
I don't know, Chris. It's, you know, you get lost in history. You get lost in stories. You get lost in a lot of things nowadays, and they try to force things on you. And I'm not a huge fan, honestly. I can honestly say that. We played in an era where it was all about history. There was, you know, it was all about records. It was all about, you know, who's doing what against who, and now it's so different. It's almost unrecognizable to me on you know, what qualifies as a great career or a nice career. Players set themselves up for their life with one win, maybe zero wins, and it you know, I hate to be an old fuddy-duddy, but you know what, you win double digits on tours. And, or you win multiple times, and you know, back in those days, now it really doesn't get you a whole lot. Now it's so much about, you know, just being comfortable and doing this and being entitled and doing that. It's just, you know, it's a little bit bothersome. I don't think the guys understand that. I don't think that they put a premium enough on actually winning golf tournaments, because hey, you finish in the top 10, you make a couple hundred thousand dollars. I mean, you have, you know, a couple good years, you set up for life. We didn't play golf, Chris, certainly in the 60s and 70s and certainly the early 80s. You didn't play golf to become wealthy. You played golf because you loved it. You wanted to win. The only way that you could get, you know, healthy in the game was to win. And so the premium was on beating everybody that you were playing against. It's not that way anymore. And I feel bad about it.
You mentioned that win got you into the World Series of Golf, and that was an event that was managed by your father, Jim. And I have to imagine after they handed you the winning check, all of a sudden the next best thing had to be, now I get to go be in an event that's managed by my dad. How great was that?
You know, Chris, I'm so proud of my dad and what he did in our game and what he did before our game in auto racing and, you know, doing that. And some of the innovations that he brought to the PGA Tour are second to none. I mean, nobody thought of a lot of things that he was thinking about at that time. And, you know, I won the U.S. Amateur in 1978. That also got me in the World Series of Golf in 1978. So that was a very, very proud moment, obviously. And then to win and then to get into the World Series of Golf as the Canadian Open champion in professionally was a super great moment in my life. And, you know, some of the things that he did to, you know, to strengthen the game, not only on the professional level, but on the marketing level, on the volunteer level, on the innovation level, on how you run pro-ams and how you get marketers, marketing people in there, how you get companies involved, how you get, you know, those big build outs around the greens. That was all his idea. And, you know, I'm not just saying that. This is a proud son talking about a father that was so innovative in the professional game of golf. And you can, this story is going back to some of those meetings, sponsor meetings, you know, in the winter time on some of the things that he was bringing to the table. And he'd look around the room and they were all kind of going, Jim, what are you talking about? And you know what? Everything is going on this day. So I'm very proud of my father and, you know, to be able to participate in the events that he was running at the time, especially the World Series of Golf there in Akron, Ohio. I'm super proud of being able to play in events that, that my dad ran. They were super good events, innovative events, Las Vegas. Nobody had a $1 million event up until he came along. The Players Championship wasn't even a $1 million event until the Vegas came along. So, you know, he was a fire starter. He was a fire starter, Chris.
Yeah. So let's take that a step further. And you mentioned winner's check. I mean, he built the World Series of Golf into one of the biggest purses on tour. The winner got $100,000 at a time when the biggest paycheck was $45,000. And that went to the winner of the PGA Championship. And then he revived the Mexican Open late in the 80s. Your father was a major force within the PGA Tour. Talk about that.
He went into a players meeting, Chris, or a board meeting, a sponsor meeting, and he told Dean Beeman, he said, hey, Dean, I've got an event. I'm going to start in Las Vegas. It's going to be a $1 million purse. And and Dean went, oh, no, Jim, you can't have a $1 million purse. The Players Championship is only $400,000. You can't have a $1 million event. He said, I suggest everybody step up your game a little bit because we have a $1 million event happening in Las Vegas in 1983, and it's going to be in the fall. So you guys have all this time to figure it out. And sure enough, he did. And it just kind of kept going from there. So it's, you know, it's like I said, he was an innovator. He was a marketer. He was a public relations guy. He understood how to get people involved. He understood how to get people on the same page. And he did it for a long, long time.
Switching gears a little bit, Cookie, something I've been calling for over the years is a Ryder Cup-like event for the Champions Tour. And we're finally going to get one in the World Champions Cup next month. What do you think about the creation of that event?
Yeah, I love it. I love it, Chris. I think it's time. Yes, we would have liked to have it, you know, 10, 15 years ago, maybe that would have been great. I think it's time because there's so much history involved in the Ryder Cup on, you know, on American soil, on European soil, on the UK soil, and to get other, you know, other continents involved. I think it's a wonderful idea. I would love to have been part of it, but, you know, I'm way past that. But I'm going to be very interested in it. I think it's a wonderful idea.
Speaking of being innovative, I read that back in June of 2017, you were at Red Hawk Run, your family-owned course at the time, and you were seen surfing down the fairway on a golf board playing Stevie Ray Vaughan and ZZ Top. Now, that's progressive and something that helped us grow the game. We need more of that.
Well, you know, when that surfboard came out, Isleworth had one. I used it a lot. I miss those days of being in the water. My wife and I talk about it all the time on, you know, we're Southern Cal kids, born in Ohio. Yes. But I was a Southern Cal kid. I went to, you know, grew up in the water. So I missed that, you know, that part of my life. And so when those, you know, golf boards came along and they were available at Isleworth, man, I took it every time I could. So it was kind of fun. Red Hawk Run also had one that I took out a couple of times there in Findlay. So it was fun. It was a great little workout because you kind of had to engage, you know, other parts of your body than just walking. So it was very enjoyable. I wish they were still around, and where they are, I don't know. Maybe they are still around. Hopefully they are, but I don't play that much golf anymore, Chris. So I miss those days of being able to be in the water and surf and then go to play golf. Well, at Isleworth, I got the chance to do that surf and play golf at the same time. Same there at Red Hawk Run.
You've done some other great design work. I read some very nice things about Desert Willow Golf Resort out in Palm Desert, California, and North Star Golf Club up in Sunbury, Ohio, just north of Columbus. Talk about those two courses.
Yeah, I haven't done much, in a long time, Chris, to be quite honest. But, the five that I did, I also did one in San Diego area was pretty good. It was called the Old Course. I think it's called the Salt Creek now. But the two in Palm Springs, I spent a lot of time on that property, Chris. I used to take, whenever I was home, I used to take one of the kids out. I had a kind of a wigged out a Jeep Cherokee that I would take out onto the property. I would go talk to the shapers. I'd talk to the architects. I would talk to, whoever's, doing whatever at the time. And I spent a lot of time out on that golf course. Desert Willow, the Firecliff, and also the Mountain View. And so I feel like there was a very special personal touch to that. Of course, Cook's Creek, they're just south of Columbus in Asheville. My dad and I and Dana Fry, we spent a lot of time there as well. And we're really proud of what that property turned into. Unfortunately, it's no longer there. But North Star was just kind of the same. It was kind of my dad's vision. And so he and I, mostly his vision, but he and I spent a lot of time planning it out, talking about it, being around the golf course, but he was there every single day working on that. So it was, as I learned the business of golf course design and construction, he also as well did the same thing. And that was his creation, and it's still going. And I understand it's doing really, really well. Another piece of property that we're very, very proud of.
North Star, I read, is the second longest course in the state of Ohio. And I know the course hosts a lot of college and amateur tournaments. With the length of the course, are you looking to bring some pro tournaments there? Or is this, college kids hit it a mile now, so we need that kind of length?
Well, you kind of need that kind of length, but you also need to have an understanding of how to play a golf course. On what it gives you, on where you can be aggressive and where you have to fit the golf ball into certain areas. That's something I learned, back in those early days in the early 90s, learning from Dana Fry. I spent a lot of time with Dana. And where the turning point was back in the early 90s was around 275 yards. Well, today it's over 300 yards. So you have to take in consideration on where the turn point is going to be on your golf hole, a par four or a par five, and understand on what makes sense and what is stupid and ridiculous, doesn't make sense. So let's give the, let's give the experience to the golfer, challenge them a little bit, maybe a little visually intimidating, but as you get out there, you understand where that turn point is and you play to that turn point. So those are things that I learned from Dana, early on in that whole golf course design career. And that I love seeing nowadays on golf courses when I go do some announcing or I do, kind of walk around or even play is, where the turning point is and you play to that point and then you play beyond that point.
So John, are you looking to do more course design work?
I would love to, Chris. Honestly, I would love to. I'm out there so much now, walking on a golf course or doing some, analyst work. I haven't done any type of design work in quite a while. I did help with Driftwood Golf Club there in Austin, Texas, with the practice area, the short game area, the practice tee. I didn't do much on the golf course because it's a Fazio, but going out on that golf course and being part of, the early construction of that golf course, it kind of got me a little bit more excited again about possibly doing some more stuff. I would love to, honestly, I would love to get back out, and put my stamp on, a piece of property or a renovation or something like that. So it's in the back of my mind. I would, very much welcome an opportunity to do that.
Cookie, just a couple more before I let you go. You mentioned your analyst work. You have such a wonderful disposition and that comes across when you're broadcasting either on TV or on Sirius XM. Was the transition to being a broadcaster difficult for you or did it come naturally?
Yeah, I have to be honest, Chris, it came a little bit naturally because all I was doing was I was playing golf without hitting a golf shot. So I was trying to explain, you know, visually and, you know, through my voice on exactly what I would have been thinking in playing this shot or playing this situation on Thursday, on a Friday, trying to make a cut, on a Saturday moving day, on a Sunday trying to finish out a golf tournament, just to verbalize, you know, what I had learned through all those years of being competitive and learning from, you know, my guy Ken Venturi and beyond, and also learning about some of the other, you know, great players that did go into, you know, that realm, into the announcing area, and why they were good, why they succeeded, you know, why some maybe didn't, you know, perform as well as they might have thought they would. So I was just trying to be myself, Chris, and try to get across to the viewer, to the listener, on what I was thinking, what I was feeling at that certain time in that, you know, whether to finish out and win a golf tournament. Hey, I've won a lot of golf tournaments and I have lost a lot of golf tournaments. So I can tell you how to do both and what went right and what went wrong. I can promise you. And when it comes to golf, I'm as honest as anybody in the world that ever played this game, and maybe a little bit too honest to myself sometimes and maybe to my detriment. But I can promise you, I know a lot about this game. I love this game of golf. I've learned from so many great people, whether I played with golf with them or whether I followed in their footsteps into this, you know, announcing world on the television world of the game. I have worked with some of the absolute best people you can possibly work with. And I learned a lot from them.
So let's take that a step further. What is something that you got to have in order, if you're going to win a golf tournament, you got to be able to do this? And what's something that's going to lose one for you?
Yeah, you can't be afraid. You have to be comfortable in uncomfortable situations. And you have to understand what a go pin is and what a no-go pin is. And you have to be able to see and feel things. And you also have to understand where you stand. These players and these psychologists that say, don't look at the leaderboard. You can't. Yes, you need to look at the leader. If you want to win a golf tournament, Chris, you absolutely have to understand where you sit. If you have to change your game plan, change it. If you don't, that's fine too. But you have to know exactly where you stand on that board and understand the situation. You don't have to go at a pin. If you've got a two-shot lead, you don't have to go at that pin. But if you're two behind and you don't know that, well, then how are you supposed to know what you're supposed to do? I don't ever understand. I can't understand that argument for the life of me. But you have to be comfortable in uncomfortable situations. If you don't have to go at a pin, you have to make an aggressive swing to a conservative target. And if you don't feel and see the shot, you don't need to play that shot. So it's just you learn that through the years. Thank God I had Ken Venturi on my side to preach to me when I was 15 years old, those exact things. Not many 15-year-olds can comprehend that. I understood that from a very, very young age. And, you know, when I did not win golf tournaments, Chris, it was mostly because I was not comfortable. I wasn't trusting myself. The events that I did win, I trusted myself all the way down to the wire. Why that is that you can't do it the whole time. That's why there's Hall of Famers and there's guys that are right on the fringe. So I wasn't one of those guys, but you know what? I love to compete. I miss competing. I played golf with some of the most amazing people. I've been very, very, very fortunate in my life.
Golf is certainly the family business, John. Last time we talked a little bit about your son, Jason, who played his college golf at Pepperdine, then played professionally for a little while, then went back to school to Penn State to get his turf management degree. Update us on how Jason's doing.
You know, he's loving what he's doing, Chris. He's still down there at Driftwood Golf Club, just southwest of Austin, Texas. He's been promoted to assistant superintendent, so he's working his way through the ranks with Driftwood Golf Club there. What their plans are for him, we don't know, but he's very, very happy. He's stepping up in that golf world. They really want him to play a lot of golf, so he's back playing some golf. They want him to be competitive, to get back into the competitive mode. there's not many superintendents in the GCSAA that have a playing resume like Jason has, and also has now, you know, the credo in that business. So they're very, very proud of Jason and what he can do and where he might be able to go in that world. But he's loving what he's doing, Chris. He is all in on being a superintendent. He loves taking care of a golf course. You got to understand, too, in Austin, Texas, they had over 100 days straight of over 100 degrees with very little rain, if any. And they kept that golf course in incredible shape. I played there a couple weeks ago. It was amazing what that crew did. Eric Pulse is the head guy. Jason and Dylan kind of run all those crews. And you know what? It's amazing what they did with very, very little help from around the area. And that's why turf grass management is so important, is to be able to keep your golf courses alive and the crews that you have and the amazing people that are on these crews. Their talent is second to none. I was amazed when I went out there and played. I was expecting something completely different, and it was like playing a tour-ready golf course. So Jason is extremely excited about where he's at. He's starting to play some more golf, and he hasn't missed a beat as far as playing golf goes. So he's got a very important championship coming up in January. It's the National Superintendents, you know, golf event. He is primed and ready to go. That's his major. He wants to play well, so he's getting ready for that.
Don, before I let you go, remind our listeners again, how can we stay up to date with all the great things you're doing? How can we follow you online and on social media?
So I'm still doing a lot of Golf Channel events. This week I'll be in Connecticut doing the Butterfield Bermuda Championship, but I won't be on site. I'll be from Connecticut, so I'll be doing more, you know, stuff for Golf Channel. Also, the Champions Tour, I'll be doing a lot more next season. But you can find me at John Cook Golf on Twitter, John Cook OSU on Instagram, also JC Driftwood. If you want to follow a little bit about Driftwood Golf Club, you can follow me on that. But, you know, I'm just so happy to be out and announcing golf. I do a lot of college events. I'm going to be doing 6 or 7 of those events next year as well. So I love the college game. You know, we just talked about college football. I love college golf just as much. I'm all in on whatever the NCAA and these great young men and women are doing in that part of the game. So I just love what I'm doing, Chris, and I always appreciate you having me on.
Well, John, that certainly all comes through when I get to talk to you and see you. You're just one of the most positive, upbeat individuals that I get the privilege of talking to. It's always a huge thrill to have you as part of the show. I can't thank you enough for all the contributions you've made to this show over the years. You've been on the show 7 times, and I'm already looking forward to number 8. I hope that's real soon.
Absolutely. I see that John Mahaffey is coming up next. Yep. One of my absolute favorite people in the world is John Mahaffey. I have learned a ton from him. Like I was talking about, he's one of the guys that I tip my cap to. A great, great human. I love me some John Mahaffey. Love that guy.
I couldn't agree with that statement more. John, thank you so much. Take care, my friend. All the best in your family. I look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Anytime, Chris. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, John. That is the great John Cook, folks. A great golf family, a wonderful man, and a fantastic player. 21 wins between the PGA Tour and the Champions Tour. Seems like a Hall of Fame career to me. You get that many wins between those two tours, it seems like that's a heck of a resume. You throw a U.S. Amateur Championship on top of that, plus some of the other great things, winning a national championship at Ohio State and the Les Bostead Award 3 times in a row in the Big Ten. That, to me, that's a Hall of Fame resume. I can't understand why John is not already in there. So hopefully that happens very, very soon. And his father had a tremendous impact on the PGA Tour and the sports world in general. And now we get to a third generation with his son, Jason. Fantastic stuff. Like I say, a wonderful individual. Make sure you're following him on Instagram at John Cook OSU and at John Cook Golf on Twitter. Like I say, 7 times, I can't wait for number 8. Just one of my all-time favorites. That's John Cook. Okay, like you heard Cookie say a moment ago, coming up next is going to be 1978 PGA champion John Mahaffey. Before I get to John, I was talking with Eddie Dry, VP of Domestic Sales for Strixon Cleveland Golf, at the PGA Merchandise Show earlier this year, and I said, Eddie, I like your CBX full-face wedges. How can they help an average player like me play better? Here's what he had to say.
An average player, I use one, and I'm in some lies that you can't even believe. And I need all the help I can get. And the face is bigger, and the grooves go all the way up and all the way out to the toe. So if you hit it on the toe, you miss it, bam, there's a groove. So I like that. So I carry a 58.
There you have it, folks. Try the new CBX full-face wedges from Cleveland Golf. I want to tell you about something else I saw at the PGA Merchandise Show, and that's me and my golf. And how does a 45-day free trial to Arco sound? Well, me and my golf have partnered with Arcos and are offering 14 free sensors and a 45-day free trial to Arcos Caddy when you purchase any training aid on shop.meandmygolf.com. This is a limited-time offer, so don't miss out. Again, go online to shop.meandmygolf.com. With many years in the business, menswear brand Construct has finally launched its green golf collection, sustainably produced using renewable solar energy and recycled fabrics. Hit your best shot in their performance-enhancing polos, quarter zips, and bottoms, made with four-way stretch, quick dry, and UV50+ protection. From solids to bold, eye-catching designs, Construct Green is the perfect piece for making the best memories on the greens. And the best part? You can head to construct.com, and that's ConstructStruct.com, and use code Chris for 20% off the green collection today. All right, now back in Next on the Tee with me is 1978 PGA champion and 1986 Players champion John Mahaffey. I'm blessed to say that John has become a wonderful friend of the show over the last few years. It's been great getting to have him share his stories and insights with us. He was a tremendous player both as an amateur and as a professional. Played his college golf at the University of Houston, where he was named first-team All-American in 1969 and 70. John won the individual title at the 1970 National Championship, and he helped the Cougars win back-to-back national championships in 69 and 70. He earned his degree in psychology and was inducted into their Athletics Hall of Honor in 1976. John turned pro in 1971. He won 10 times on the PGA Tour, including that 1978 PGA Championship, which was played at Oakmont, when he came from 7 strokes back with 14 holes to play to win in a playoff. He also won the 86 Players Championship when his 13-under score bested Larry Mize by a stroke and another great friend of the show, Tim Simpson, by 5. He won once out on the Champions Tour. He was a member of the victorious 1979 Ryder Cup team. In 1983, he was inducted into the Texas Golf Hall of Fame. He has written several wonderful books, including Hogan's Boy, A Journey in Golf, plus a golf-related mystery novel series around Terry McCall, a fictitious superstar on the rise who gets into all kinds of hair-raising situations. The books are titled Shafted and Unfinished Business. You can find them out on johnmahaffeyauthor.com or on Amazon. And I couldn't be more excited. I get to have him back with me again tonight here on Next on the Tee. Hey, John, how are you, my friend?
I am doing so good, Chris. It's so good to be back. And I guess Cookie got the check I sent him about the promo. That was awful nice. You know, I guess it was enough. We had so much fun working together on Golf Channel. And I really got to know John. We got to play a little bit, you know, after we got off the air and stuff. And him being with knowing Ken Venturi so well and Hogan and Venturi being such good friends, we had a lot in common to talk about, and it was so much fun. I missed those days.
John, I want to start out our time tonight talking a little Western Pennsylvania golf, with the show now being a part of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and they picked up the show a couple of months ago. And I know we've talked about your 78 PGA Championship before, but for the listeners now in my hometown of Pittsburgh, what are your memories of trying to go out and win a major championship at Oakmont and dealing with those greens?
Well, quite honestly, at the time, in 1978, I'd only made about $10,000 going into that tournament. I don't even remember how I qualified to get in, to be quite honest with you. But, and I opened with 75. So I really wasn't trying to win. I was trying at that point. I was just trying to make the cut and maybe, get to where I could get make some money. All right. Yeah. But Oakmont was I played poorly there in the U.S. Amateur. I think the year Steve Melnick won there. And I was scared to death of those greens. I really was. In fact, I changed putters before I went there. I borrowed my mother's putter. All right.
Is that right?
8802, yeah, that I gave her way back in the day. And I took that putter because it was so light and felt like I could control it better on those really, really quick greens. And after the 75 that I shot at, I went to the practice tee and I played early in the morning. So I skipped lunch, went to the practice tee and practiced till dark. And when I left, I felt like I might have come across something, found something that felt good. And for the next 3 days, I played some of the best golf I've ever played in my life and putted like a dream with my mother's putter.
Do you still have the putter?
You know, I don't. I can't find it. I've moved so many times. Yes. I cannot find that thing. Oh, well. Somebody's got a good putter.
No doubt.
Yeah, yeah.
John, after you won that PGA, you backed it up the very next week by winning the American Optical Classic. You beat the defending champion, Raymond Floyd, and the only optometrist on tour, Dr. Gil Morgan. Seems kind of ironic that you would beat Dr. Gil to win that event.
Yeah, Dr. Gil was one of the most talented players out there. And he was one of the guys that I always liked to listen when he played because it didn't sound like he ever missed a shot. Everything was so solid. It was almost Hogan-esque in the way he did that. Beautiful player. And I was lucky. Raymond had his stare going that week, too. But I was coming off an emotional high of winning the PGA. Obviously, it changed my whole life. And I kind of just drifted along and ended up beating him head to head the last day up in Massachusetts. It was yep. A wonderful Pleasant Valley. One of the longest golf courses on the tour, which really probably shouldn't have suited my my style. But I don't think I missed many greens that week. And I putted very, very well.
You mentioned changed your life. I was curious, after winning a PGA, carrying that emotion, winning the very next week, to your point, having not won a lot of money out on tour, how much did your life change just within that 2 week span of time?
Well, there was a lot of things that happened before that, Chris, that you never really make up for things that don't go your way. But you can sure make them, you can feel better about them and use them as experience. Let's put it that way. I had lost back-to-back U.S. Opens in 1975 and 76 and wondered if I'd ever get another chance to win a major championship and to actually have that come true and to win by playing so well for the last 3 days. There really was something that got me kind of over the hump. And then winning the next week obviously was a boost as well. But you always, especially when you have Ben Hogan as your mentor, and he sort of has you figured as a guy with the potential to be in the Hall of Fame. It's definitely a guy that can win major championships, and to have come up short twice and then finally doing it, it was quite a relief.
John, I want to get your thoughts on equipment changes. Did you ever, when you were out playing on tour and you're playing across the country, obviously the tour is taking you through the seasons, through different climates. And especially if you went over all those years that you played in the Open Championship in England and Scotland, did you change equipment at all to deal with the different turf conditions you were going to face that week?
No, and I guarantee you my buddies on the tour would laugh at that question. I changed all the time. I really did. I think between me and David Graham, we probably changed clubs more than anybody else out there. I think I don't know anybody else that would have done more. But I learned a lot about club making and everything from Ben Hogan's club maker, Gene Shealy, when I signed with the company before I even got on the tour. So I learned a lot about different stuff, but I went with the equipment that they wanted me to play, that they were promoting. I didn't stick with one particular set of clubs because they were all very, very good. And some of them, they actually used some suggestions that I had about maybe softening up the bottoms a little bit more. So it suited my game. And it was just a wonderful relationship I had with Mr. Hogan, as well as all the people at the Ben Hogan Company.
You played a lot of golf against the guy that we just lost in Andy Bean. What do you remember about Andy?
Golly. That's, he was an enigma in a lot of different ways, I suppose. I mean, he was one of the kindest guys in the world, but boy, did he ever get mad at himself. The fact that, you know, people talk about him biting through a golf ball. He bit all the way through into the rubber, into the winding of a golf ball when he got mad at it. I could bite a little bit of the cover, but I wasn't strong enough to. He could take on a bear with that kind of strength in his jaws. It was amazing. Very powerful player, very talented player, great touch. Loved his sense of humor. He loved the outdoors. I did as well. So had a few things in common that way. I wish I'd have gotten to be a better friend of his, but tremendous competitor and just a wonderful, wonderful guy.
He was one of your teammates on that victorious Ryder Cup team in 1979. Looking over the results of those matches, you were 1-2 overall, but really 1-1 against a guy that I think is very underrated in Brian Barnes. You and Hale Irwin lost to Bernard Gallagher and Brian Barnes in the Friday morning four ball. You got your revenge by beating Brian Barnes in the Sunday singles. Like I say, he was a great player. What do you remember about competing against him and being a part of those Ryder Cup matches?
It was such an honor. I was never been more scared in my life, Chris, ever. You know, going to that first tee, and it for my own one and only Ryder Cup in 79, it was, I wasn't playing particularly well, and Billy Casper knew it, and I didn't figure I'd be playing a lot. So when I played Barnes in the singles, I really wanted to make a statement. I wanted, like, I really belong there. I finally kind of got, okay, enough of this. Let's go play some golf. And I played pretty well. I think I beat him 2-1, something like that. But, you know, and he's the guy that brought down, what did he beat? Nicklaus twice?
Right.
Yeah. So, I got that going for me, Nick. Jack Nicklaus. Take that.
John, there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking going on right now for why this year's U.S. team lost. What's your assessment? Why can't we seem to beat these guys on a consistent basis?
I honestly don't know. I really don't. Maybe too much good old boy stuff. I don't know. You read all this kind of stuff, and it's hard. I know that when Billy Casper came up to me and he'd asked me if I'd play with so-and-so and so-and-so, I'd said yes. It didn't matter. I didn't care who I played with. You know, I wanted to play and I wanted us to win. And I don't know. I honestly don't know. That's a question that I don't know anybody knows the answer to right now.
Switching gears a little bit. In 2003, John, you made the transition from being a tour player to being an analyst on the Golf Channel, working for our good friend Keith Hirschland. What was that transition like for you?
Well, it was great. Keith Hirschland was after me for a while to get on the Golf Channel. And he actually talked to my wife, to Elizabeth,
right? You know,
and trying to get me to go on. And I kept saying, guys, no, I can still play. And so finally, I guess she'd had enough of it because I was playing on the senior tour at the time, trying not to finish last. And I'd never played golf like that in my life. I mean, it was survival. And, you know, so Elizabeth took me aside and she said, I talked to Keith today and he really wants you to do this. And I think you should. And I said, why are you pushing this so much? She says, well, I'll tell you what. You can't play. You can't roll over and play dead right now. You're finishing last every friggin' week or close to it. You know the golf courses, you know the players, and you're articulate. And you're not afraid to speak up. Anything else you need to know? And it kind of made sense. You know? And then I got to work with Keith, and when I decided to do it, I can't remember when we were up at the Farmers Classic or something, and he called me, and he said, look, you play in a pro-am tomorrow early. I want you to come over by the trailers and I want to give you a clipboard and a headset. I want to send you out and see if you can do this. That was my training.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, and you just try to find a spot where guys can't hear you. And you know, if they can hear you, they give you the evil eye. You know that. So, you know, and that's kind of how I got it started. And Keith was so good to me. And really a mentor in that, and in other ways too, later on down in the way of my life. But, you know, when I came on, every announcer, and I guess this is common, when you're just starting out, you have a go-to phrase. And mine was, I tell you what, guys. And so every time they come to me, let's go to John Mahaffey at 15. Well, I'll tell you what, guys, you know. So after a while, I hear in my ear, he says, you got to lose that. You got to lose that, you know. So I did my best for a while, and I guess I wasn't very good at it because we went to Hawaii or somewhere, and the first hole they come to me on, I said, I tell you what, guys. And in my ear, I hear, and there's some profanity, and I'm not going to use it. If I hear that one more time, just drop the headset, turn around, and give them and the clipboard, and get yourself on an airplane and get your back home. We don't need you. And I tell you, and it was funny because it I stopped at that point. And then Keith, I guess, kind of left the Golf Channel after that, about a year after that. He came back to do occasional tournaments, and I happened to be on one of the crews. And when they came to me intentionally, I said, I tell you what, guys. And he says, you don't do that anymore. I've been listening. So, I mean, he's always had my back, and I really appreciate it, as did most of the folks at Golf Channel. They were very gracious to me in a lot of ways. And I learned a lot. I had a great road family. Let's put it that way, that, you know, I wouldn't trade for anything.
So I got to ask you, you mentioned getting the evil eye. How do you go from being a peer to a lot of the players out on tour to not raising their ire while you're trying to be objective in what you're seeing and call what's happening out there on the golf course? How do you not upset them?
I'll give you a great example of that. And Keith was the producer on this thing. And Bobby Watkins had a chance to win one of our majors. It was up in the Northwest somewhere. It might have been in Portland. Anyway, he comes to the 18th hole and he hits this great tee shot. It's par five. Perfect in the fairway, hits this big towering like 5 wood. It hits on the green. The green was really, really hard. And it took one bounce and jumped over the rough and almost went out of bounds. And I think Elgato won the tournament. I'm not sure. But anyway, he ends up making a really 5 footer for par, something like that, and loses by a shot. And so he comes, I'm waiting for Bobby to come out of the scoring tent, and Keith says, you need to talk to him. I said, Keith, I don't know. He says, it makes for good TV. And I'm thinking, man, I don't even know what to say, you know, because it was just a horrible break. It's nothing he did wrong. And it was just like, you know, karma got him or something. I don't know. Anyway, I wait for him outside and we walk out and he kind of looks around and he looks at me and he says, you want to talk, right? And I said, yeah. He says, JD, you know how it feels. I'll talk to you.
Wow.
So I thought, yeah, you know, you've been there. You know, and it kind of made me feel like, all right, I'm not really the enemy, you know, and which, you know, so, let's face it, some of the guys were, you know, they were looking for all the negatives. I learned a lot from Dave Moore back when at ABC. I worked a couple of times when I was injured, and he always put the player in a good light. He never really, threw a guy under the bus. He said, you know, he obviously didn't want to hit it there. He's got a marvelous short game. Let's see if he can get it up and down. Or, you know, he's got a great attitude. If he makes bogey here, maybe he can make birdie at the next hole. I mean, something positive out of a negative. And that's kind of how I tried to do it. And some people said I wasn't hard enough on people. What, you know, I worked with Lanny, so we had one that was hard enough. We didn't need two.
John, before I let you go, update us. How is the novel series coming?
It's going great. It's going, I mean, Shafted, Unfinished Business, and Dead Quiet are all published now. And those three are in paperback, ebook, and audio. And then I've got Blindsided, which I just finished and it's in editing. And I'm about 3/4 done with my fifth one called Cornered, which is a sort of a split off on the other books to go with a more of a, well, it has to do with the lawyer that was a golfer and stuff that ended up working with Nemesis. So it's going great. It really is. It's awesome. I'm having a blast. They're all on Amazon, easy to find. I'm pleased. I'm very pleased that we're getting a good response. I've got a lady that does the best covers in the world, book covers. They're awesome. So, you know, I got the people I work with are ladies and they're great. They're very, very at the top of the line in the business. So I can't complain.
So, John, how can our listeners stay up to date with all the great things you're doing and follow you, whether it's on your website or it's on social media?
Well, I'm Hogan's Boy on Twitter, and I'm on Facebook, and John Mahaffey, and I've got johnmahaffeyauthor.com, but I don't really tweet as much. I'm writing so much, it's unbelievable, as you can imagine. I mean, I've been away from the Golf Channel 4 years now, and I've got 5 books out. I mean, that's a lot of writing, because you end up rewriting these books 4 or 5 times before you send them to editing. So it's not just like you just throw it down and there it is. It doesn't happen that way.
Well, John, it's always so much fun when I get to have you as part of the show. You're one of my all-time favorites. I can't thank you enough for coming back and joining me for a 6th time tonight. I hope we get the privilege of doing number 7 very, very soon, because you're one of the best.
I appreciate that, Chris, and so are you, by the way. Congratulations on all the awards. You deserve them.
Well, I appreciate that very much. John, take care, my friend. All the best to you and your family. We'll do this again soon.
Thank you, sir.
See you, John. That is the great John Mahaffey, folks. What a wonderful individual that guy is. He is just so much fun to have as part of the show. Great stories, great insights, and now a great writer. This series is so much fun to read. It's a page turner, right? You're going to get the book and you're going to be going through the book and you're going to be reading. And the next thing you know, hours have passed and hundreds of pages later, and you just can't put them down. That's how good his writing is and how compelling the story is. So please go out there and check it out and give him a follow again at Hogan's Boy. And the book that he wrote that's about golf, Hogan's Boy, A Journey in Golf, is fantastic. It's a great read. Great insights into the tour, into Mr. Hogan, and into John's career. So I highly encourage you to go get those as well. We'll get John back on the show again real soon. Coming up next is going to be Bob Friend Jr. And Bob is just one of the great players in the Western Pennsylvania area. He was a grinder out on tour for many, many years. And he has just been a wonderful friend of the show going all the way back to season 1. Before I bring Bob in, I want to remind you about 2-Under men's performance wear. They're the unofficial underwear of the PGA and the 2020 Ryder Cup team. Ricky Fowler is their global ambassador, and over 50 other PGA, Korn Ferry, and Champions Tour players wear them. Just to mention a few, like David Toms, Jerry Kelly, Justin Thomas, William McGirt, Scott McCarron, and Chris DeMarco. The Joey Pouch technology provides the ultimate male asset management, delivering maximum comfort from the tee box to the boardroom to the bedroom. Use code NXTONTEE20, so next on T20, to save 20% at checkout. So go to 2under.com, that's the number 2UNDR.com. 2under, performance in your pants.
Relax.
Easy now. Find your happy place. It's all in the hips. Just tap it in.
Yes!
Find the latest clubs and apparel at Golf's Happy Place, the PGA Tour Superstore.
Now next on the tee with me, and I'm honored to say this for the 18th time, is obviously one of my all-time favorite guests, Bob Friend Jr. Bob is a wonderful friend of the show, both on and off the air. He's been a great part of this show since the very beginning, going all the way back to season 1, episode 3. And 750-plus shows later, he's become a wonderful regular contributor to this show. He is from my hometown of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, played his college golf at LSU, where he helped them win the 1986 SEC Championship. Bob had 11 career top 10 finishes while he was there at LSU. He won the Western Pennsylvania Amateur Championship in 1984 and 85, and the Pennsylvania State Championship in 85 as well. He turned pro in 1987. He played on the Korn Ferry, PGA, and Champions Tours. He had 5 top 10 finishes his rookie season on the Korn Ferry Tour, including a second-place finish at the El Paso Open. He got his first win at the 1991 Fort Wayne Open. In 98, Bob won the Panama Open and finished 2nd in the Canadian Open. And over the course of his career, he's finished in the top 10 27 times. In 2003, his high school, Fox Chapel, inducted him into their Hall of Fame. And if you're a baseball fan, I always like to remind folks about this. You'll remember his father, Bob Friend Sr. He pitched in the major leagues from 1951 to 1966, mostly with the Pittsburgh Pirates, and was a key member of their 1960 World Series championship team that beat the New York Yankees. And I am so honored and privileged that I get to have Bob back again with me tonight here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Bob, how are you, my friend?
Chris, I'm doing well. How are you? It's always good to speak with you. It's hard to believe. It's 18 times your show and 750 shows. That's quite a benchmark.
I appreciate that very much. You're a huge contributor to the show, so I can't thank you enough for everything you've done for me and the show. I want to start, as you know, the show is now available on the Pittsburgh Tribune Review site, and you've had a ton of success in the Western Pennsylvania PGA section. I want to go back to 1984 when you won the Western PA Amateur Championship. It was played at Oakmont that year, so kind of a home game for you. You beat Kurt Beck and fellow Oakmont member Mark Bope, who won the club championship multiple times there. What do you remember about that win?
Well, it was, you know, 1984. I'd played in the U.S. Open as an amateur. I'd played in the U.S. Amateur in 83. And so in 84, you know, the West Penn Amateur was a big deal. Obviously, it was played at Oakmont, 54-hole tournament. And, you know, I had qualified for the U.S. Open at Wingfoot in 1984. So my confidence was running very high. And obviously, you know, having been a member at Oakmont at that time was, you know, for, gosh, I think 12, 13 years then at that point, very important for me to go out there and to win that golf tournament. And I remember I had the lead after the first day. And then the second 2 days, we played all the way back. The golf course was very firm, very fast. And Kurt Beck, who at the time was also playing college golf at University of North Carolina, very talented junior player throughout my career. And I remember I won in the third playoff hole, the third hole at Oakmont, and we were both so exhausted because you played 18 holes on Monday, and then you played 36 on Tuesday, and you played 18 in the morning on Tuesday. There was a cut. You went out and you played in the afternoon, 18 in the afternoon, and we were just, I mean, Oakmont is just, it's a mentally exhausting test of golf. And I remember I actually won on the third hole, beating Kurt Beck in a playoff with a double bogey.
Wow.
I made six, he made a seven, and it was just, you know, we were both so exhausted. But, you know, you just take a look back at some of the, you know, some of the watershed moments of your life. I mean, winning the Western Pennsylvania Amateur, you know, was one of those moments to realize, you know, you can win, you can compete. And then next thing I know, you know, I won the West Penn Amateur again in 85 and the state amateur then 86. I won, you know, the Northeast Amateur, the Mid-Atlantic Amateur, the Maryland Invitational, and, you know, had a chance to make the U.S. Walker Cup team in for 87. So 84 was really my first big win in amateur golf. I'd qualified for the U.S. Junior Amateur at Longview back in 81. I was a medalist there. But really, the West Penn Amateur was my first big win. And anytime you win, it builds confidence. And I'll never forget that. I'll never forget making double bogey against Kurt and winning on the third extra hole of sudden death.
So let's take that a step further, because you come back and you win that tournament again the next year in 85, this time at Chartier's Country Club there in Pittsburgh, an old Willie Park design. What do you remember about repeating?
I can tell you, I can't remember. You know, you sit back, you take a look at 30 years or 40 years now. And, I do remember that I was never in danger of not winning that golf tournament. I think I shot like, you know, like 68 the first round, like 67 the second round, and then maybe like a 71 the third round. I was never in doubt of winning that golf tournament. You know, you sit there, when you sit there and you play, you know, I was defending champion, then you go and you go back to school, you go back to LSU, and you play, and you play Division I college golf at a high level for, you know, an SEC, you know, team like such as LSU with great players on it. You know, you come back and you play in your local events. It's like, yeah, I'm quote unquote big time now, and your confidence is high, and you just realize that, you know, you play a little bit better and you believe in yourself a little bit more than the rest of the guys you're competing against. So 85 was a little bit easier. And then later in the summer, I won the Pennsylvania State Amateur, which was played at Longview. And I won by 8 shots in the Pennsylvania State Amateur later in the summer. So, you know, you sit there, as Jack Nicklaus so famously said, winning breeds winning. You know, you win these golf tournaments and it just does nothing but, you know, build your confidence as you move forward.
Yeah, when I look back at that Pennsylvania State Amateur Championship in 85 at Longview Club that you mentioned, which is in Verona, near my hometown of Penn Hills, right down the street, actually, from where my father grew up on Lime Hollow Road. You beat Ted Treba, who won a couple of times out on the PGA Tour. So let's talk about that. It's not like you didn't outdistance a field of really, really great players.
Yeah, Ted, his nickname on tour was Ted Try to Keep It Out of the Trebas, which he was getting. That was one of the monikers he was given from the guys in the PGA Tour fitness trailer. But yeah, Ted was a great player. There was another guy named Jim Hagstrom, who was another good player, ended up winning at Marion, I believe, in 1986. So, no, it was one of those things where I think I shot 66, 68, 70, 70, 71, 70, or something along those lines. I know I won by 8. So, again, it's just one of those things where, you know, as a boy, my goal was to play in the PGA Tour when I was 14 years old. I decided that's what I wanted to do. And then you sit there and you start winning some amateur tournaments, start seeing some success. It just builds your confidence. And then for me, the big, the big year was, 1986, where it just so coincided that all these major amateur tournaments that I was playing in were opposite. Like I couldn't try to three-peat the West Bend Amateur because it was opposite in a tournament. I couldn't try to defend my championship, the state amateur, because it was opposite a major amateur golf tournament. So it was just one of those things where I couldn't play in this, couldn't play in that. Then I, in 86, I won the Monroe Invitational, which was match play. I beat Len Matisse in the finals. And then the week later at the Northeast Amateur, I won the Northeast Amateur by 7 shots, which is now considered one of the elite amateur tournaments in golf. But even back then, 40 years ago, it was considered one of the top 6 amateur tournaments in the United States.
Bob, when people think of Pittsburgh sports, golf doesn't immediately come to mind, but there are so many great golf courses in the Pittsburgh metro area. Obviously, you're a member at Oakmont, but there are some really fantastic golf courses in and around Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania. What are some of the other ones that you really enjoy playing?
Well, I think you take a look at Fox Chapel Golf Club, which is an old Seth Rainer. They've gone and they've done some renovations to that over the last 10, 12 years. It's brilliant. You've got the Pittsburgh Field Club, where we played the Frank B. Fuhrer Family House event there. And we also played the FBF Junior Invitational, which is a tri-state section PGA tournament, the largest section event purse in the United States. And they also played the 1937 PGA Championship at the Field Club. Denny Shute won there. You've got Laurel Valley, which is Arnold Palmer's playground. You've got Latrobe, which is where Arnold Palmer grew up. You've got Neville, which is a Nicklaus development. You've got Diamond Run. You've got Treesdale. You've got Longview Club, which has some of the best views in all of Pittsburgh from any golf course, and one of the greatest clubhouses you'll ever see. And literally, you take a look at Longview and you play the front nine. It's like, yeah, it's kind of shortish. And yeah, you might be able to make some birdies. And then you play 15, 16, 17, and 18. And that is all you would want in terms of a last four finishing holes in Western Pennsylvania. So there's a lot of really great golf course. Another one that a lot of people don't know anything about is Hannistown. So Hannistown was designed by William Leffler, who was the first golf course superintendent at Oakmont. And he designed the front nine. And then it was a 9-hole golf course, designed the back nine. But Hannistown is loaded with great golfers. Out there near Greensburg, and there's just so much great golf here. And obviously, the king of all kings, Arnold Palmer, is from Western Pennsylvania. So it's a great area for golf. Obviously, the Steelers, the Pirates, the Penguins, but the people in this area, they love their golf.
Bob, you mentioned the Frank B. Fuhrer event. I had Chris Sheehan on the show last week, and Chris is the head professional out there at Pittsburgh Field Club. You've competed at that event several times over the years, including earlier this summer when Eric Cole won. Talk about what it was like playing out of the Pittsburgh Field Club.
Well, I can tell you, I first retired from tournament golf in 2003. When I decided to step away from it, I asked my father, I just said, I pulled my father aside. I said, I'm thinking about maybe it's time. And I had just turned 40. I had 3 kids. I was married. And my dad said, well, what's on your mind? I said, I just don't know if I want to put in the work. He said, that's when you need to step away. He said, when I stepped away at the age of 36, he said, in my mind, I knew that I no longer wanted to put in the work necessary to be at the top of the game. And that's where I was. And so I retired in 2003. My next year in 2004, Mr. Fuhrer was kind enough to extend an invitation to me to the Frank B. Fuhrer Invitational. And at that time, it was a $25,000 first place. So I finished second to a guy named Brad Westfall, good player out of West Virginia. And I competed each and every year as a member of the Tri-State section of the PGA. And then 2008, I went out there and I shot 69, 68, 69, 68. And I won by five shots, $25,000 first place. And, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, it's a seminal event in the state of what, you know, in Western Pennsylvania. And it was just, it was such an honor to win the tournament with Mr. Fuhrer's name on it, because he's done so much for local golf here in Western Pennsylvania. And his son, Frank B. Fuhrer III, you know, he played in the Walker Cup in 1981, won the Western Amateur, played in the Masters, just a wonderful, wonderful golf family. And I competed this year. It was the last year of the event. Eric Cole, I played with Eric when I was trying to get ready for Champions Tour events back in 2014. Mr. Fuhrer had pulled me aside one year and he just said, you know, do you know anything about this Eric Cole? I said, wonderful kid, great player. I said, I think he'd be a great addition to the tournament. And obviously with his father being Bobby Cole and Laura Baugh, Mr. Fuhrer brought him in there. And, you know, Eric's just a world-class player. Take a look at what he did this year. So I don't compete much anymore, but it was nice to compete at the Pittsburgh Field Club. I did not compete as a senior. I competed against the young guys and finished about in the middle of the pack. So, you know, as a guy that's 59 years old, not too bad.
You've also played in the Palmer Cup, a match play event where the top 10 Tri-State PGA professionals play against the top 10 Western PA amateurs. It's played at Arnie's home course there in Latrobe. You had the distinction of playing against a Western Pennsylvania amateur legend and Sean Knapp, who's in the IUP Hall of Fame. He's also won the Western PA Amateur Championship 9 times. He won the U.S. Senior Amateur Championship. What was it like drawing him in that event?
Well, Sean is, you know, Sean, I've known Sean since my amateur days. You know, my amateur days ended March of 1987. Sean has been a fixture in Western Pennsylvania golf for years. You know, he's always a very good competitor. And, you know, it was one of those things when you go and you take a look at it, you know, Sean was always at the before he won the U.S. Senior Amateur, obviously a very good player. But everybody looked at Sean like he was a big fish in a small pond. In Western Pennsylvania, you know, the pool of golf is not like you see in Florida or you see in Texas or in Oklahoma or in California, New York. So Sean goes out and he wins the U.S. Senior Amateur Championship. And it was basically the stamp of approval in amateur golf for Sean Knapp. And so Sean, you know, he's always a great competitor. I don't think I played particularly well that day. Actually, I don't think either one of us played particularly well that day, but Sean's been a great player for a long time. And anytime you get the opportunity to go up there and play Latrobe, you know, you see the covered bridge there when you walk on the back nine, I think it's number 12. You know, it's always a special experience to get out there where you take a look at the fact that the greatest legend in the game of golf, this is where he grew up and he owned this golf course. It's always a pleasure. And, you know, we as Tri-State section professionals, we got our rear ends handed to us by the amateurs. But again, they're playing a lot more golf than most section professionals. And but it's always a fun event run by the Tri-State section of the PGA. David Wright at that time, Dennis Derrick, they do a great job. And it's just always nice to compete.
Just a couple more before I let you go. And you've seen the course at Oakmont go through some pretty major changes over the years. The last time you were on the show, you were talking about more work being done to the course now. Talk about the renovations and the transformation that you've seen Oakmont go through over the years.
Well, I can tell you we've been very, very careful with what we do at Oakmont Country Club regarding it's the Mona Lisa. I mean, when you go and you take a look at this, the first golf course rankings came out in 1966. Oakmont has always been in the top 10. This is something where Mr. Phones passed away in 1938. So when we took a look at this, I was on the board when we made this decision for us to go through with this renovation. Obviously, at the advice of Bob Ford and others, we spoke with Gil Hand. And at the time we hired Gil, Ben Crenshaw was our quote-unquote restoration architect. Ben, wonderful guy, play with him. He's world-class human being, world-class architect. Was very reticent to do anything to Oakmont. And so the interesting thing with what we did was we brought Hance in. Gil Hance had a great idea. And he said, look, I'm not going to go and and take a look at aerials and then bring the golf course back. What I'm going to do is I'm going to look at aerial photographs, all the photographs we have between 1925 and 1938 when Mr. Phones passed. Anything after that, we threw it out because Mr. Phones was not alive. So what Gil did is that Gil took a look at each individual hole and what he felt was the best version of that hole in that time period. And so some of the holes haven't had a whole lot done to them. Some of the holes have had dramatic changes done to them, such as number 7. All the green complexes have been changed on the perimeters. They've not touched anything on the interior of the greens. So there's hole locations that I have seen that I have never seen in 50 years being a member of Oakmont. But what he did at like number 7 was that way in 1938. And if you go and you take a look at what he's done with the fairways, Oakmont had gotten become very much like a bowling alley. The fairway is straight. You've got a gutter ball left and a gutter ball to the right. What Hans did, now you go out there and you get on these holes and you see a little bit more of the snaking serpentine of the fairways. It was a little bit more of the strategy brought in, but he got rid of a lot of the saddle effect that you have on greens after you have top dressing over the years and greenside bunkers where people hit shots and the sand piles up. So a lot of the saddle effect on the greens have been taken away. And in my opinion, having been there for 50 years, I think that what's going to open up in April of 2024 is going to be the best version of Oakmont Country Club that we have ever seen in my lifetime, and really what we've ever seen in almost 90 years when it reopens in April. It's going to be amazing.
Bob, one more, and I want to get your opinion. The framework of the partnership between the PGA Tour, LIV Golf, and the DP World Tour is set to expire on New Year's Eve. In your opinion, where do you think this whole thing ends up?
Well, at the end of the day, you knew that there was going to be a partnership between the PGA Tour, LIV, and DP Tour. I mean, you cannot have bifurcated tours that don't have any relationship to each other with the greatest players in the world. That's not good for the game of golf. I think everything is going to continue under the PGA Tour umbrella. I know for a fact that a lot of the LIV Tour guys, although they've made enormous amount of money, I think a lot of the guys are kind of frustrated with the idea that we're really just kind of playing exhibitions. You know, the inside track that I've heard from some of these guys and their managers is that, you know, I've worked my whole life to be here, to get to the very pinnacle of the game, and I'm out here playing in shorts. They're playing music, and they're 54 hole tournaments with no official world golf ranking points. Look, I think at the end of the day, I think everything's going to be brought together. I think it's going to be good for the game of golf when all three of those entities get together. But I just think that this LIV, I'm delighted to see that Greg Norman is going to be out. Greg Norman is a cancer to the game of golf. He has had a grudge against the PGA Tour since 1994. It's a tour that basically helped enable him make wealth beyond his wildest imagination. And, you know, he's done nothing but bash the PGA Tour since 1994. So I'm glad to see that Greg Norman is out, as is everybody that knows him. But I think that at the end of the day, I think it's all going to come under one umbrella. You're going to see some added tournaments, some larger purses, and some more worldwide exposure.
Bob, you're a fantastic realtor now there in the Western Pennsylvania area. Talk about the things that you're doing with Howard Hanna.
Well, Howard Hanna is the largest family-owned real estate company in the United States. We were started in 1957 by Howard Hanna. Yes, it was a real human being. And we now currently have about 14,500 agents across 13 states. We're the fourth largest real estate company in the United States. And I manage, having had a very successful tour as a real estate agent, I'm now an associate broker. And I manage the Squirrel Hill office, which is a suburb, which is a city office in Pittsburgh. And I manage a little over 60 agents. And out of the 450 offices we have, the Squirrel Hill office is the fourth largest in terms of volume. I also have the most instrumental investment specialist in all of real estate in my office. His name is Ryan Shedlock. He sells properties. You know, he sold $55 million worth of real estate last year alone, and that's just as a single person in the Pittsburgh market. You know, he can sell that in Dallas in like a month, but in Pittsburgh, to sell $55 million worth of real estate is unheard of. So the market right now, it's a little bit it's a little bit crazy because interest rates approached 8%. Now they've dipped back down to 7%. We're still in a seller's market. There are still buyers out there looking for homes, and we just don't have a whole lot of inventory. It's hard to discuss people moving up or moving to that next home or either right sizing when they're in the current home at 3.5% or 3.75% interest, and you're asking them to maybe put their home on the market 7.5% and buy the next home at 7.5%. So it's a little bit of a challenging market, but at the end of the day, you know, people are going to buy real estate, and we've got the finest agents in the business here at Howard Hanna.
Before I let you go, remind our listeners, how can they stay up to date with all the great things you're doing and follow you, whether it's online or it's on social media?
I would go to Instagram at HH Real Estate MGR Bob Friend. That is my business Instagram. I usually post stuff out there. I do a lot of liking, but it's HH Real Estate MGR Bob Friend. You can follow me on Instagram.
Bob, it's always a huge thrill to get to spend some time with you. You're obviously one of my all-time favorites. You've made this show into a lot of what it became because you came on a show 10 years ago that you never heard of with a guy you never heard of, and that really got me launched, and I can't thank you enough for everything you've done for me, the content you've shared over the years, and what a wonderful friend that you've become. Thank you so much.
Well, Chris, you do a wonderful job, and again, my invitation stands, Oakmont Country Club, fall of 2024, you and me, brother.
I'm looking forward to it. Trust me, I'm going to hold you to it because I can't wait to do it.
You're in, baby. You're in, baby.
I appreciate you, Bob. Take care, my friend. All the best to you and the family. We'll catch up again soon.
Same, Chris. Hey, have a wonderful Thanksgiving. God bless.
Thanks. Same to you. Take care, Bob. Bye-bye. That is the great Bob Friend Jr., folks, and a finer individual you will not meet ever in life. He has just been such a wonderful friend and a mentor to me and a great guest over the many times he has been a part of this show, 18 times. I mean, that says a lot for who Bob Friend is and how he came on a show. Like I say, that he never heard of the guy, never heard of the show, but he was willing to do it and has become just an integral part of this show's growth over the years. And he shared so many wonderful stories about his playing career, about his father, his family. I can't thank him enough. Hopefully we get the opportunity to catch up with him again real soon. And I'm going to take him up on Oakmont in the fall of 2024. Can't wait for that to happen. Coming up next is going to be one of the top 100 instructors in our game, a guy who has been named such for over a decade now. And like Bob Friend, just one of the most wonderful people that you'll ever meet in this game. And that is Eric Johnson. Before I get to Eric, and folks, do you sway and you're off balance in your golf swing? You know what? It could be your shoes. A golf shoe needs structure to provide stability and reduce sway. How can you tell if your shoes lack structure and are hurting your game? If you can hold your shoes by the toe and heel and twist it, toss it. Squares was designed for the perfect balance of structure and comfort. Isn't it time you tried Squares? Try the new Speedbolt at squares.com. That's SQAIRZ.com. Looking for the ultimate Myrtle Beach golf experience? Well, it's only a click away. Check out the two-play special at two of America's most awarded public golf courses, Caledonia Golf and Fish Club and True Blue Golf Club. They are low country masterpieces featuring two iconic Mike Strantz designs. Play these two incredible courses for one great price. Visit CaledoniaGolfAndFishClub.com to learn more about the two-play special and book your tee time today. Again, that's CaledoniaGolfAndFishClub.com. Speaking of a guy who has been on this show 18 times, so has my next guest, Eric Johnson. Eric is a top 100 instructor in our game, but like Bob Friend, one of my all-time favorite people on the planet. He's also been a great friend of the show. He's also been a huge part of this show's success going back to the first season that we did this show. No one makes a segment more fun or one that I enjoy being a part of more than Eric does. Let me give you some background on E. Played his college golf and was a four-year letterman at Mississippi State from 1992 to 95. He helped them win back-to-back Kroger intercollegiate titles in 94 and 95. Golf Magazine has named him a top 100 instructor every year since 2011. He was also recognized by Golf Digest as a top 40 under 40 teacher. He's a three-time Tri-State Section PGA Teacher of the Year. He is also a four-time winner of the Horton Smith Award for his contributions to education. He played out on the Canadian Tour, the Sunshine Tour, and the Golden Bear Tour. He was the director of instruction at Oakmont Country Club for many years. He is now the director of instruction at Yellowstone Club in Big Sky, Montana. He is back in Pittsburgh for the winter, and I am honored he is back with me tonight here on Next on the Tee. Hey, how are you, my friend?
Chris, my man. How you doing, buddy? Hey, what a wonderful show, with the exception of Friendly there. I'm glad I'm on second.
I'm glad he hung up the phone.
I am too. He'll probably text me tomorrow. You son of a... Yeah, anyway. Yeah.
So, E, you tell me you're back in Pittsburgh now after another great season out there at Yellowstone Club in Montana. Talk about how it went in Montana this year.
Yeah, it was an amazing year. It was my best one out there, for sure. Our new director of golf, Drew Glover, is just knocking it out of the park, and it was amazing to be out there, and words can't describe the beauty of this place. I mean, until you really see it, people don't, you know, kind of understand how amazing it is. And, you know, we lost, unfortunately, Mr. Weisskopf, but we had some great tributes to him this year. And he was such a tremendous human. And I will miss him every day. He was just a wonderful, wonderful human. I know in his earlier part of his career, he got that, you know, volcano kind of personality, and he was, but in the latter part, he figured it out, quit drinking. He was just a superhuman, and I'll miss him. So it was an amazing year. I caught a ton of fish. Not that the listeners want to know about that, but I slayed him on the trout stream this year. I mean, I'm telling you, I pestered my poor friend Patrick Boyle. I kept sending him video after video of me catching fish after fish. I'm like, hey, wish you were here. Not. So I got under his skin. I think he blocked me after a while. But anyway.
Are you a catch and release guy, or are you eating the fish?
Oh, shit. I let them all go back. Yeah, no, they need to live. They need to live in the beauty of Montana. And I'm just there to see them and say hi and let them go. You know, no, I don't keep any of them.
So, E, for our listeners who've never even considered Montana as a golf destination, have you ventured off Yellowstone and seen other great courses that we should definitely have on our list to go check out?
Oh, absolutely. We have three within a few miles. Spanish Peaks, unbelievable. Moonlight Basin, where they filmed or the match, and it's amazing. I mean, you drive for miles, like you go, am I going the right way? And there's a sign that says, yeah, keep going that way, keep going that way. I mean, it's out there in the middle of nowhere, and it is extraordinary. But yeah, you know, I mean, Montana has so much great golf. I think it's Black Bull down in Bozeman, and you know, Stock Farm, and all those great places out there. I mean, you wouldn't think it was, because the season's only 4 months, but holy cow, is it unbelievable. And the views and the vistas, that's the thing that really cracks me up about, you know, YC, is that you stand on 3 and 4 and you just look at, you know, miles and miles of mountain ranges, and it's stunning. I have no words. I can't articulate it. I'm having more fun out there than I ever have in my career. And that's the truth. I mean, listen, I love Oakmont. I love Bobby. But Oakmont is such a rule-oriented club. I mean, you got to play in 4 hours. You have to have all these rules. You can't use cell phones. You can't do this. You can't do that. You know, I mean, we're out there. It's just everyone seems to be out there just going, holy cow, I'm in Montana and I'm enjoying my life. And not trying to get philosophical, but I think people need to enjoy their lives a little bit more, because we're not here on this earth for a long time. And, you know, and when you see a place that's wide open like that and just says, enjoy your day, you know, my God, what's more, what a novel concept. Have fun on a golf course. You know, I don't know. It's a cool place. It's a very special place. It's unlike anything I've ever seen. I mean, you know, we had Nick Faldo there last year, and I saw Nick at the, this true story, Chris, you can't make this up. I saw him at the grocery store, and I'm like, "Hey, Mr. Faldo." And he goes, "Hello, hello." You know, he always says everything twice. If you didn't notice that, it's kind of like Mo Norman. But I said, "Welcome to Montana." He goes, "Oh, thank you, thank you." And off he goes. He put his little buggy in the little cart return thing, and then off he went in his car. I was like, "What in the heck is Nick Faldo doing at a grocery store?" You'd think he'd have somebody for that, but then he came up later in the year and he played with Ming Tsai, our executive chef at Baba, and played with Drew Glover and his wife, and so we're like, "Well, what do we say? You got Nick Faldo there. What do you call him? Because we're a first name only club. I mean, if Justin Timberlake comes in, hey Justin, hey Tom Brady, hey Tom, hey, you know, Bill Gates, hey Bill," which is quite funny. And I said, "What do you call him? Do you call him Sir Nick, or do you?" and our director of golf goes, "Yeah, we'll just call him Nick. It's a first name only club." So we're like, "Hey Nick, what's up? How you doing, man?" You know, we took a picture. It's hilarious.
That's great. Eric, I had Kelly Stenzel on the show a couple of months ago. Kelly said you guys did a clinic together up there this summer. Talk about that.
We did. We had a top 100 teacher school. I had Stan Utley a couple of years ago in, and we did a short game only school. And I had the idea of bringing in some great, you know, teaching professionals and do a school. And we did 3 days. It was unbelievable. Great turnout. We did a morning session, we did an afternoon session, and we had a 9-hole playing lesson that you could sign up for too. And it was very well received. We had Kelly Stenzel, we had Carly Snyder from Cabo in, and they just knocked it out of the park. I mean, I think that our members love those girls more than they love me, because they keep asking if they're coming back. They're not asking about me. I'm like, "Hey, what about me over here? I set it up." but they really just did an awesome job. I mean, it was, we really grinding, you know. I mean, we started early and we went to noon, and we went to, you know, at 9 to noon, and we had lunch real quick, and then we went 1 to 4, and then we went 4 to 6:30 in this playing lesson. So these girls, they did an awesome job. They worked hard. Their content is so good, you know. And when you get Kelly and Carly and, you know, together, and, you know, just to see the way they work hard. And, you know, it was funny. Someone said, "You know, I was a little confused after the pitching, you know," and Kelly said, "Let me find that person and go find out what that was about." And that's just the professional that Kelly is. She wants everybody to understand what we're talking about. And she's awesome. I mean, she's, I've known Kelly for a long, long time. I think she was gotten the top 100 a couple years in front of me. I think hers was 2009, and she just deserves every bit of it. She's just awesome. She's a great professional. Love that girl.
Eric, one of the themes of this week's show was golf there in Western Pennsylvania. At Chris Sheehan on the show last week, he said you were recently out at Pittsburgh Field Club and remarked to him about the great condition that golf course is in. Talk about PFC.
Yeah, I saw him in the grocery store of all things, and I said, "Christian, I can't tell you. I mean, you know, I was at Oakmont for 17 years. I've been in the section for all these years, and I have never seen it better in my life." And my son was playing in a high school match, and he shot 38 and lost by 8 to little Davy Fuhrer, which the grandson of Frank Fuhrer, which Bobby was talking about there. I heard that. And little David shot 30 at the Pittsburgh Field Club. And that is not a golf course that people shoot 30. That's how great this young man is. I mean, he birdied 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I mean, and I look at it and I just go, wow, I just don't see the front nine of Field Club being a place where you shoot 30. But it is absolutely in the best shape I have ever in my life seen it. And I've been in the section since 94. So I'm a Mississippi Stater, you do the math, but I think that's about 29, 30 years. But it's unbelievable how good a shape it was. I know people want to tar and feather me when I say this, but I think that might be the best one in Pittsburgh
Wow.
Yeah, no, people want to turn Feathermead and they say, wait, how can you say that? You got Oakmont's number five. I get it. Oakmont's unbelievable. I get it. But it's so hard, you know, for like someone that can't play very good anymore. It's like, wow, I don't really, it's too hard. You heard Jack say, I the game's too hard. I ran out of golf balls. That's what I feel like when I play Oakmont anymore. I just don't, you know, I just in the field club, they've got great members. I mean, when you think about the greats, I mean, you know, obviously you could think about the big six, obviously Oakmont, Laurel Valley, Pittsburgh Field Club, Fox Chapel, Longview, Allegheny. I mean, all private clubs that are phenomenal. I love Laurel. I love Oakmont. Please. I was there for 17 years of my career. It has such a soft spot in my heart, but it's so darn hard that, and I heard, you know, Bobby talk about, you know, changing that golf course. And I'm kind of a little bit with Ben, you know, you kind of go, wow, I mean, you really want to change this? I mean, it's so good. But, you know, time marches on and we'll see. And I think from everything that I hear, it sounds phenomenal. So I haven't, you know, I've only been home for, you know, about 3 weeks now and I haven't seen it yet. And I haven't walked it. So, but I can't wait to see it. And they've always been innovative. And I do appreciate that. You know, I mean, started with that tree program in 96, 97. We cut them at night, you know, and I know I've said this, Bob Ford's wife was mad at him that they were standing in the kitchen one night and said, Bob, do you hear a chainsaw out there? And he said, no. And she's still mad. They were cutting at night. And she's like, you lied to me. Well, I didn't lie. I just said I didn't hear it, you know. he's got some explaining to do there. So, yeah, but, you know, and then you think about, you know, like, Cranberry Highlands and Old Stonewall here in Pittsburgh, really great golf courses. And then, you know, I have the luxury of playing Katanning Country Club every Tuesday with guys up there. They let go of their professional a couple of years ago and they said, can you help out? Can you teach a little bit when you're home? I know you're going to Yellowstone. I'm like, guys, I'd rather just pay and be a member. And they're like, well, how about you just help us out? And then, you know, so I go up there and play with Cliff Forrest, who owns Penn Breweries, Iron City Light and Icy Light and Iron City. And so we partake in a few of those each Tuesday, which is great.
No doubt.
It's my favorite. And Tony Calandra, Jen Marr, and Joe Avi and Randy Schreiber and all the boys up there. I mean, I'm just so lucky to in my life to be able to do those things and to hang with my friends and every Tuesday it's a treat. It reminds me of my home club of Titusville Country Club, where Gene Sarazen was the head professional in, I want to say, 1919 to 21. Which reminds me of when we went to Augusta. Fred Brand used to take us to Augusta and he would fly us down. We'd be the first on the plane and we'd go to Augusta and we walked out onto the terrace at the Masters, and you're up on the second floor there, and there's Gene Sarazen, and he's sitting all by himself, and it's Monday, and so Fred Brand was like 6'5", monster of a human, and he walked over and said, "Who got it for you, 1920 in the Pennsylvania Open?" And little Gene Sarazen looked up and said, "You did, Freddie, you did." You know, it was. I'll never forget it, and. And then so we went back to Augusta with Mr. Usher and we walked onto the second floor. I looked out and I'm like, there's Gene Sarazen. And then he wasn't there. And I looked at everyone. I said, did anyone see just see Gene Sarazen? They're like, Eric, maybe you need to lay off the Iron Cities. I said, I haven't had anybody. I think he was there. So he was, what an amazing, amazing memory that
no
was.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Speaking of great golfie that you get to play, you were telling me that you went out to Southern California and you played Monterey Peninsula Country Club, Pebble Beach, Cypress Point, and Spanish Bay back in September. Talk about a great golf trip. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was an amazing trip. So a couple of good friends of mine at the Yellowstone Club, Mike Michelson and Peter Cowie, every year we go on a trip. And, it happened the first year I was there, they said, hey, you want to go to Bandon? We're leaving on Monday. And I said, yeah, I do. And so we went out to Bandon, we've gone to Gosser. And then so this year they said, where do you think we should go this year? And I said, man, I don't know. I mean, we went to Bandon, Gosser, and then Peter said, you know, Doc says he can get us on Cypress. And I said, you know what? I think we should do that. Yeah, that's a good idea. Let's think about this. Yes. And so long story, Chris Sullivan's a minority share owner of Pebble, and they were at a party, and Peter said, hey, are you still at Myronite? He goes, yeah, you know, I am. And he goes, well, if you need anything, let me know. He goes, well, as a matter of fact, we're playing Cypress. So he goes, yeah, give me a week. And a week later, we had a tea time on, you know, Pebble Beach. And, you know, and then we played the Monterey Peninsula Country Club, which was amazing. Pebble was iconic. And then you play Cypress, which is without a doubt my number one in the United States of America. I fell in love with it. I walked off the, you know, the golf course, and Casey, the head professional director of golf, was there. And I said, Casey, this, how anyone could not see this as number one in the United States of America? I can't see it. I don't know. I mean, it's that good. And then a member would happen to be standing there, and we started shooting the breeze, and a guy named Murray Bodine, and he walked in and he gave me the book. He goes, I want you to have this book of this architecture of, you know, Alastair McKenzie and Cypress Point. And I was, oh my God, it installed my belief in the United States of America that good people are still out there. And it was amazing. And I played Pine Valley a couple weeks ago. And in my opinion, maybe it's the mystique of I played Pine Valley probably 30 times with McGraws, but I fell in love with Cypress. You get the seals barking, you get the, you know, the seagulls and the everything flying around on the ocean. And it's just, it's amazing. I texted our friend Nathan Smith, who should definitely do that your show. And I said, Nathan, you're the Walker Cup captain, and you're at my favorite place in the United States of America. The golf course is that great. I said, I can't wait to see you. You know, Nathan's he's an assassin. I mean, his golf is outrageously good. He is a mind. He's like a Jedi mind scrambler. I'm telling you, this guy has Jedi effect on people. Like, he just knows how to get in people's head. If you like to play fast, he plays slow. If you like to play slow, he plays fast. I mean, he's just all over the place. He's amazing. And he will guide that team to a win, unlike our poor Ryder Cup, you know, captains can't seem to do, but Nathan will bring home a win.
So, okay. Now we got to take that step, because I need to understand from your opinion, why can't we get this Ryder Cup thing right? Why do we keep losing to these guys?
I have no idea. We got the best talent in the world, and it's like they play tight. It's in their head. Chris, I can't explain it. There seems to always, I mean, think about it. It goes back to years ago when Duvall said we need to get paid, and you know what? I heard Friendly say Greg Norman is a cancer. Maybe Greg Norman was right. I believe my member Phil Mickelson was correct. I said this to you in the past. I think he's the smartest man in the room. They pointed out something that was going on that, you know, where's the money go? Like, you know, where is it going? We don't know. Now the guys make hundreds of millions. The PGA of America makes hundreds of millions of dollars for the Ryder Cup. And where does it go? And so Duvall had a kind of a legit point, in my opinion. I know people want to tar and feather me over that one too, but he kind of does have a good point. Where is all this money going? And they said, well, we're going to give the guys $200,000 to their charity. Well, okay. I mean, they win a tour event, they make $3 million, and this is, you know, I mean, come on, you know, when money gets involved, and egos get in the way. And, you know, there's some stuff that goes on there. In my opinion, they seem to play very tight. The Europeans, like, they get together, they sing songs, they drink beer, they have fun. I think they kind of got the second side of it correct. They seem to be more friendly. They seem to be more play for their country, their town. Not that this has any relevance to it, but we used to go play Oakmont versus Loch Lomond Cup matches, and they were playing for their town, their club, their country, and we were trying to drink them out of scotch, you know, and you're like, guys, we're here to win. You know? Like, I want to win. Like, I want that silver scabbard. Like, I want to win. And so we had to reel the guys in a little bit, but there's a different in my opinion, and, you know, I don't want to hate mail. In my opinion, they seem to have a little bit more of a, it's about winning. And it's about coming together, where our guys seem to be a little bit aloof, and they seem to a little bit out there. Are we going to have live players? We're not going to have live players. Did we send our best team? Did we not? I would say maybe we didn't. You know, controversial pick. You know, I mean, when they say, oh, you can't leave Justin Thomas out. Okay, well, Lucas Glover won two in a row and was like on a hot streak. He's running a heater. So you kind of pick the guys that are on a hot streak, you know, but, and I get it. Like Justin Thomas, I wouldn't want to face him. Rory McIlroy said that. There's a lot of other players I want to face. But I don't know. It seems like we're getting in our own way. It seems like the Europeans make it more about the European team and that culture of getting together and being a team. I guess finally, I just think we look like we're playing tight. We think like we should win and we're not. And so now it's getting in their domes. And that's, unfortunately, I don't have the answer. If I did, I'd be the Ryder Cup captain.
All right. So let's switch things up a little bit. I want to get a playing lesson from you. And
yeah,
starting to get cold in your neck of the woods. The turf conditions, once the temperature starts to fall, turf conditions get tougher. The ground gets harder. Lies get tighter. Most of us can't go out there and change up our irons and our wedges based on the time of year. So what are some things that you think we need to do as the temperature drops and we're playing in the cold weather in the mornings and the early part of the afternoons or late in the evenings and that ground's tight? What do we do differently to make sure that we are not thinning the ball over the green and chunking it 5 feet in front of us?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I mean, first of all, when it gets colder, the ball goes shorter. And unfortunately, mine goes shorter and shorter every day. I mean, there used to be a day where I was like, wow, I hit that pretty good. And now I go, wow, that's all it went. So, so that's why I try not to play when it gets cold. I love to play out west where it kind of goes a long ways at 9,000 feet up there. I mean, it's kind of cool. But when you get back here, use more club. You know, when it gets the fairways get a little firmer, you know, you got to tack down on it just a hair more. So the shaft lean is imperative that you're hitting down on the ball a little more, catching the ball first, especially in hard conditions, you know. There's legendary stories about Hogan growing up and, you know, how sharp the leading edge was on his irons because he, you know, was so firm in Texas and he, you know, needed to catch into the ground. So, I mean, to me, shaft angle and shaft lean is imperative. If you bounce, you know, behind it, you're going to hit off the, you know, the ground and you're going to scull it. So, you have to have some shaft lean and that use more club. It's cold and really start leaning that shaft a little more and catching the ball first would be my best advice for that one.
Eric, before I let you go, and I know you've never been a social media guy, so folks listening in that want to stay up to date with you or looking to get lessons, whether it's in the Western Pennsylvania area or looking ahead to next year when you go back out to Montana, how can they find you?
Come on, man. I posted something about
you did know, the, not.
I did. I posted about the Cypress trip and how much I loved it.
Where
that was
you
a month ago
something?
Or so. I mean, like, I'm on it.
Where?
So, yeah,
I gotta
on Facebook.
Find it.
Come on, man. We're friends.
All right.
So, Facebook, Eric Johnson Golf. I keep saying this. I'm going to do more on.
Yeah, of course you are.
Twitter and whatever. And I'm on there too. And Eric Johnson Golf. And what is it now? X and Instagram. I know, you know, my man Patrick Kane used to post a bunch of stuff when on Instagram for me. And I'll revisit how to do that. But I'm there. And, you know, I just want to thank the Golf Magazine guys. And I was voted in for the 23 and 24 year as well for the Golf Magazine Top 100 Teachers. And also want to thank you for always being there for me. And I've said this, you're so prepared. I don't know how you know all this stuff about me. It's like you're wiretapped in my house or something. I don't know how you know all this stuff, but it's kind of freaky, but I love it. And you're the man.
Yeah,
play Longview too. When you come up and play with Friendly, you know,
yeah,
come up and play Longview. It is unbelievable, and then you want to see a real thing of beauty. You come out and play YC. Mr. Weisskopf did an amazing job out there.
So yeah, I want to come to Montana so bad. I keep telling my wife we need to move to Montana. She's not buying into that, but I want to come to Montana so
too.
Bad.
You and I are having the same problem, brother.
I know it. I want to come to Montana so bad. So hopefully I can make that trip happen sometime while you're there.
Well, you come out and see us. You won't be disappointed. I know it. It's a slice of heaven out there. I just love it.
Eric, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to come back and be a part of the show an 18th time tonight. I can't thank you enough for everything that you've meant to me in this show over the years. You are absolutely one of my favorite people on the planet. You're just a gem, my friend.
It's an absolute honor to talk to you every time. I was so fired up today. I was looking at my clock going, oh my God, it's a couple hours. I can't wait to talk to Chris. So thank you for having me. And I'm shocked that a little kid from Titusville, Pennsylvania ever gets on anything, but I really appreciate it, Chris. I appreciate you, sir.
Same here. Take care, E. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up again soon.
Yes, sir.
See you, Eric.
Bye-bye.
That is the great Eric Johnson, folks, top 100 instructor every year for the last decade, and just one of the great people you get to meet in course of doing a show like this or in the golf industry. He is a gem of a human being. He is obviously being a top 100 instructor. You know, he's a great instructor. Well, he's a 10 times better person than he is an instructor. So that tells you what you need to know about Eric Johnson. And again, just like Bob Friend before him, Eric came on a show he never heard of with a guy he never heard of 10 years ago. And he keeps coming back, and I am so blessed that I get to say that not only do I get to have one of the top 100 instructors in our game as a fairly regular guest, but he is a friend on top of that. So a huge blessing to me in this show and to all of us in the golf world, because a better instructor, you're not going to find anywhere on the planet. So Eric has done so many great things there at Oakmont for almost 20 years, and now out at Yellowstone. To tell you the truth, Montana is just a place that I am dying to go check out and be a part of. And that golf course is just so beautiful. It's private, so I encourage you to go check it out just to take a look. But some of the other courses that Eric mentioned in and around that area are just as breathtaking. The views, he talked about the vistas, the views out there in Montana. Golf in Montana is so underrated. You got to go check out those courses. Check them out online. And then do yourself a favor, make one of your buddy trips out to Montana. I know that is one of the places that I want to go. Hopefully I get to do it while Eric is still out there, because I want to see Yellowstone from all the things that he has said about it. We'll get Eric back on the show again soon, folks. I can't wait for that time. It's 18, already looking forward to 19. Folks, before I close up shop tonight, you've heard me talk about some great products that I saw at the PGA Merchandise Show. And another one that stood out to me is On Point Golf. Game-changing, three-dimensional ball markers that science shows will help us see the line better when we're putting and therefore make more putts and lower our scores. See for yourself why Jim Furyk and I are big fans by going online to onpointgolf.us. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on this edition of Next on the Tee. Want to send out my sincere thanks again to John Cook, John Mahaffey, Bob Friend Jr., and Eric Johnson for joining me this week. Scheduled to join me next week are, of course, our resident director of instruction, Tom Patrick, will be back with us, as will Champions Tour pro Rob LeBritz. Really looking forward to having Rob back as part of the show. PGA Tour Superstore COO Randy Peisch will be here, as will another one of the top 100 instructors in our game, John Hughes. So a lot of great stuff on tap for you next week. I hope you'll come back, tune in, and be a part of it with us. You can find this show available as a podcast just about anywhere you get your podcast content. But in particular, we are out there on TribLive.com and the Pittsburgh Tribune review site. So just go to TribLive.com, click on sports and then podcasts, and you're going to find the show front and center, available free for you there. You can also find the show out on Good Pods, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audio Boom, and Player.fm. And as always, thank you so much to the folks over at Good Pods for making this show one of their recommended podcasts and a staff pick. Please download their free app and stream your favorite podcast right there on your favorite device. But most of all, my sincere thanks to all of you for being the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts. I appreciate you all so very much. Until next week, hit 'em straight, my friends. Well, I guess.